Alright. Good evening, seekers. My name is Damon and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Damon.
He neglected to say that he withstood about a two-hour drive down with me to Macon and down there. And he didn't jump out of the car or anything like that, so.
6 in the morning?
Yeah, it was 6 in the morning, yeah. Service. My sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004, so I'm in 14 years right now, just to save you guys the math. I was born in Georgia Baptist Hospital in 1955. I'm 63 years old, to save you the math again. There's a lot of people here that I think have heard my story, I'm reminded, I've heard this on the tapes a lot of times, Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. You know, he knew what was expected of him, but he didn't know how to make it interesting. I want to touch briefly because I think it's very, very important in this program to qualify. When I was 8 years old, I was sniffing glue. When I was 10 years old, my sister turned me on to marijuana because it was a step up. And then about 12 years old, we all got a different alcohol from the parents' liquor cabinets. Of course, it was my idea. You know, I think that's why later on my parents actually, they locked the liquor cabinet. But they forgot to realize that the hinges had the screws on the outside. So they kept wondering how their alcohol kept getting missing when they had it locked up. They built another house and they put the lock in where you couldn't do that anymore. So my parents actually, you know, designed part of the house they built to keep me out of their liquor cabinet. So I think that tells you a little bit about at least my early drinking. Of course, I was a child of the 60s kind of thing. You know, we were doing all kinds of stuff. I remember helping a guy make candles down in just outside of Settlement Piedmont Park, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. Going down there with my guitar, selling joints out of my guitar in case, you know, at Piedmont Park. And there was always some beer and everything, but really during that time, I wouldn't say I was an addict in any way. It was all very, very recreational. Bill talks many, many times in the book, he keeps using this word about our drinking careers. I think what's important is when did drinking become serious? You know, when did it become part of my life and that I needed to drink in order to make it through the day? When did that happen? And for me, I've always kind of been a seeker. That's why I think a lot of people who come into AA and stay in AA are seekers. We're seeking something. I think we were seeking something in the bottle. We were seeking something in the drugs. And I remember I was 15 years old, and this one of these hippies asked me if it was a coincidence, if you're a Christian in a Christian country, if it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, if I was born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be Islam. If I was born in India, I might be Sikh or Hindu or Muslim or, you know, Buddhist. So I started seeking around, and I actually wound up, I'm one of those, has anybody here ever been told you had a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? Okay, got some hands out there. Yeah, I'm one of those who had a C average. I was in elementary school and public school and having disciplinary problems, you know. Today they give you Ritalin, back then they gave us paddling. And a guy decorated the paddle. I don't know, I still think that's kind of sick. My parents took me to a child psychologist and they said he's bored. And they sent me to a private school down in Buckhead. I think it was very good for me that way, but I was really the outsider there. You know, my family really stretched and strained to send me there. My parents did. But like a lot of things in life, I didn't appreciate it that much. You know, I got passing grades, C grade, you know, stuff like that. But too busy. You know, at adolescence is very naturally self-centered, you know. But I think I can look back and say there was a lot of that in my early time. But I was a guy who, sometime in the 70s, I quit smoking weed, you know, and I really wasn't drinking alcoholically. My parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. And they'd all, I was the youngest one, so they'd always wanted to live on a lake. I remember going up on a boat and we used to cruise around on the lake and look at all the different cabins and the houses and they would plan. In fact, my parents, when they met, the first thing they owned was an outboard motor and they would rent the boat to go on it. So, I mean, they were very much into going up, and we used to come up to Lake Allatoon all the time. And I really grew up in a family that was, we were a very good family. My mom was just, her natural state of being was to be of service. That's just who she was. My dad, a traveling salesman, very outgoing and had a lot of fun. And, you know, when he traveled sometimes 2-3 weeks at a time, but when he came home, he spent time with us. You know, although he was also in the JCs, which is sort of the opposite of AA. That's where you learn how to drink. In fact, that was later on. I was president of a local chapter here of the JCs. But my story really is, I lived down in downtown Atlanta for a year, and I decided that it might not be such a bad idea to apply myself and actually get a college degree. And that's really where that willingness comes from. You know, I found out in this program I've got a lot of willingness to do all the service and all these other things, and I can't give away a thimbleful of it. For some reason, I don't know, it's somehow that's a gift, and I can't explain it. I don't take credit for it either. I'm very grateful that I've got that. But I went down, and I couldn't get into Auburn, but they were living just north of Auburn. Went to a little junior college there, and did very well. It kind of was like, you know, the extension of Alabama high school, really, in some ways. But I applied myself. I did all the work and turned in the homework on time. And so my parents said, well, you can go anywhere you want to go. And I wound up flipping a coin after calling a long-distance operator in Colorado and picking Colorado State because I wanted to go to the mountains up there. That was my higher education that I was going for. And got up there, and that first week, there was a little meeting where they're handing out refrigerators, and I sat down on the couch and kind of butted into a conversation with two late gals that were talking there. And coming up in October, we'll be married 40 years. So, but I like to think she's very stubborn. I don't think she ever wanted to admit she made a mistake when she married me during those drinking years. I think also I tell people she collects species. I was the first one she collected. We have goats, we've got chickens and roosters, and now we have a frog. I've been in our house and we've been trying to figure out what this noise has been in the house. And so we finally isolated it down today. There's this little ledge right above the sink where she has all these plants growing there. And then there's a gray tree frog. We don't know how it got there or what, but then she goes and pulls out of the closet a reptilian aquarium thing. Well, one of the things I'll get to this in a little bit because it really reflects on all of these things, but that's this. When I met her, she was taking welding. She had burns in her jeans from the welding. She had stains on her fingers from woodworking, and she smelled of formaldehyde because they were dissecting a corpse in anatomy. She's an occupational therapist. And I thought, this is a fascinating life. You know? And she's always been into a lot of stuff, you know? I used to call it clutter. Okay? And in fact, you know, we got married, you know, was going and taking special history with specialty in India and China. I wanted to know more about what are the different cultures, you know, seeking out. Had a year of Chinese language. But I took a year off, and I worked in a nursing home for that year. And I got to see people looking back on 105 years of life, looking back on 75 years of marriage, 94 years, you know. And I saw the families handling it well, and I saw families not handling it so well, squabbling over the inheritance, the whole deal. And so I got some lessons from that that carried me through the 80s. I did not drink alcoholically during the 80s. I did not. I could take it or leave it. I was really on a corporate, because what happened was I came back here. I was going to go into international business. The marketing department was on the same floor as that. I got involved in the American Marketing Association as a result. I wound up getting a job. Turns out there was more, you know, there was a lot of, you know, opportunities for jobs. And then I got recommended to work for a division of Equifax that did marketing research. And I worked there for 12 years and went on to that to work for Hewlett-Packard for a number of years. And I was building out data centers, and we were doing all of this really, you know, messing around with multi-million dollars worth of equipment, playing around with other people's toys. And my son was born in 1984, my daughter in 1989, and then around that time, I started going from being an optimist about life to being a pessimist. And William James, in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is one of the books Bill was given in December of 1934 during his stay at Towns Hospital. And in that book, William James talks about what are the common traits that someone has who goes through a spiritual awakening or a religious experience. And there was a couple of things. First of all, you don't find God on the mountaintops, you find God in the valleys. And the other one was a shift from pessimism to optimism. And I had done the reverse. I had gone, one of the guys I worked for had a bachelor party. They went to a belly dancing deal, and then they went to a strip joint. Well, when I was 6 years old, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members. So I, when we went to this strip joint, all of a sudden I went, whoa, they got an adult version. And I'm thinking, I'm not getting this at home, you know, and start doing rationalization and justification. And I remember a few weeks later, I was working late and said, I need a massage. I've never had a massage. Maybe I'll go get a massage. And then I got there and the lady offered me the full treatment. I didn't know it was one of those massage places. And I took her up on it. And I thought, well, you know, in China, in Japan, they have concubines, you know, which is a woman, you know, the wife knows about and all that, and relieve the sexual pressure. Well, there was only one problem with my little story, and that was, I'm not Chinese or Japanese, and my wife is not Chinese or Japanese, and I am not going to tell you no. But what happened for me is the guilt kicked in. My mama raised me better than that. I like a lady, she said she came into AA when she could no longer lower her standards to match her behavior. And so I began, but it didn't, you know, I just began to rationalize and justify, and then I started going to these places. And I was working a 24/7 shop. It was an outsourcing. We had a data center, and so I could have any excuse to be there at any time, coming and going. And I thought I could control it. And I want to state a little bit about what I think I want to do as a theme for tonight, and that is success. When I was 12 years old, my definition of success was, I got away with it again. Anybody else have one of those? You know, sneaking out of the house through the window. You know, I remember one time I got caught. That's a long story. And, but that was my definition of success at that time. And here I was, like 25 years married, and I'm going around getting pleasure by sneaking around again. Like my MO, pleasure by sneaking around. And that was my definition of success. Pretty poor definition of success. And I just kept getting away with it, and I thought I was successful at it. Of course, I had a DUI in like 95 or 96. Had a half a fifth of Courvoisier in me and another half under the seat in downtown Atlanta, turned in front of a police officer. Wound up, by the time they took the blood alcohol, it was just below 0.12, so I was able to plead no low on it, spend the night in jail. But after I got out, I said, I am not going to drink. I am not drinking again. And that lasted for 6 months. You know, the something that came very clear to me a couple of years back, I was at the jail meeting doing the work release over there, and there was a guy there, and I had told my story about this, about how many times, you know, as I got going through this, I would drink till I got to like a fifth of vodka, and then I'd just quit, you know, and I'd brush myself off and I'd quit for sometimes 2-3 months, sometimes 2 weeks. But eventually I would change my mind about not drinking. And so this guy, he says, wow, I loved your story. You know, when I get out of here, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. And he said, what do you mean? And I'm thinking, well, I'm still formulating this. I mean, you know, it's one of those. And I said, well, quitting doesn't work. And I realized this isn't a program for quitters. This is a program for starters. I needed to start becoming a good father. And when I look at the things that a good father does, drinking is not on the list. And there's a big difference, at least for me, between not on the list and quitting. If I'm quitting, it's still one of the things I'm on the list doing. I'm busy doing something I shouldn't be doing. You know, I'm thinking about something. And I love this idea that the shift that happened in me, I wound up getting put on probation because somebody smelled that alcohol in my breath around this millions of dollars of equipment. This was in April of 2001. And I quit drinking. And I turned on the afterburners again. Anybody else do that? You know, we were able to get accolades and, you know, work productively. You know, we can really bounce back. And then the CEO laid off everybody in the corporation who was on probation as a money-saving measure, regardless of what their, you know, current. So all of a sudden I'm out of a job. But I still am not drinking. I'm telling them I'm going to be a millionaire when I get back here in a year. Today I'm a millionaire many times over in an entirely different currency. See, I didn't want the car. I wanted the way I thought I would feel when I got the car. I wanted the quality of life I thought I would have when I got the house. I wanted the quality of life I thought I would have. And the thing was, when I got it, it was never enough. Anybody else have that? You know? And it was one of Eric Clapton who said, acquisition is not where it's at. And that's a guy who could acquire a lot. But I've come to realize today that the quality of my life has nothing to do with my circumstances. At first, I thought it had a little bit to do with my circumstances. But I've come to realize it's got nothing to do with my circumstances. I read a book about a guy who went through Auschwitz as a Jew and survived it. And he was able to circumvent and go under the rule and be able to help out a number of people who were there and ease their lives. And it turned out to be one of the highest quality times in his life because of what he was able to do. Mother Teresa, where did she practice? One of the hell holes on earth, the slums and the dumps of Calcutta. So if I think the circumstances, if I'm saying, and this is the second part of the first step. You see, when I told that guy, you know, quitting isn't the answer, I realized that when I first read the big book, I thought there's a step missing. Does anybody else notice the step that's missing in the big book? The one that says quit drinking? It doesn't say that. Bill says, you're powerless. You will not be able to quit and stay quit. Okay. Plan B. You ready for plan B? Let's arrange my life in such a way, you know, just like arranging these chairs in the room. Let's get them all just, and then I won't have to drink. Anybody ever tried that? It don't work. You see, so I can't be focusing on the circumstances of my life anymore in terms of the stuff around me or that. And it begins to be a shift into my relationships. My relationship with my wife, but with each and every person around my relationship. The most important relationship I have is my relationship to time. If I think I've got to get there, and get the stuff so I'll be happy, then you're either in my way, you're helping me, or you're inconsequential. I'd like to change one of the ABCs that we read at the God could and would if he were explored. You know, it's like I'm right here, right now, and if I'm exploring this moment, God is everything or He's nothing. So you're part of this moment, this everything. You're part of this. Can I explore you? When I'm exploring you, I'm exploring God. And then you're all part of what I'm exploring. That's been a lot of the shift. So here I am. It's 9/11. I'm over at my sister's in Birmingham. The planes have run into the towers. I know that my industry has changed. And it had. I'm still not drinking. But 2 days later, my sister and brother-in-law go to a German club to go drinking, and I'm going to do that. But I knew where the blackjack was. You know that? You know where? We know where that stuff is. I remember seeing, we were at the Woodstock of the South up in Lake Lanier Islands, and they have this knight in armor, and he's got this bottle of wine right in front of him. And we were trying to figure out whether that was an Al-Anon or whether that was the alcoholic. Is the Al-Anon guarding the bottle, or is it the alcohol guarding the alcoholic guarding their rights? But you know, it was my. I kept going through this period where so I'm sitting there, and I know the blackjack's there, and I go, I'm going to have one drink because I still don't know about the allergy, and this is so important to this. I crossed a line during that time. Where today, if I take drug alcohol into me, I become a different person. And I could no longer tell me what that guy's going to do, and I could say what you're going to do when you drink. Has anybody else told you act differently when you drink? You get a different personality? So what makes me think that I can do anything about that guy? And that would be perfect. My sister, she's never allergic to poison ivy until somebody burned a bunch of it in the house behind her. Now she's allergic to poison ivy, but she has no interest in going out and finding the stuff and rolling around in it because it doesn't do anything for her. If I'm an alcoholic, alcohol is not my problem. It was my solution. And alcohol transported me into now. It made me okay with everybody that was around me, or I just didn't care whether they were around me. At the end, I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day, isolating myself out, cutting every thread I had, connecting me to the rest of the world. Because I couldn't handle relationships. And it turns out that all the stuff I ever got was never enough. I was out of plans. And so from 2001, I would drink and cough, and then 2003, I'd quit for 3 months. It was Thanksgiving. I made an excuse, said my client's got something I need to do, I gotta go back to Atlanta, left my family I get along with, took out money out of a bank account we couldn't afford, drove to Birmingham to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing, don't think about it. La 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 la. Anybody else done that? La 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 la. And drove and went to a strip joint, then went to a massage parlor, and 3 days later I had 105 degree temperature. And when it broke, I had a strange condition where when I urinated, I was passing gas and debris when I did that. And I'm like, you know, alcohol really is a very dangerous drug in terms of what it affects in our bodies and number of things it does. And this is December, and finally in February, I go do something about it. Anybody else guilty of wishful thinking? You know, maybe it'll just go away. Now, I would not pee into the cup because I had to drink to drive there. By now, I'm drinking daily. But I'm okay with the guy doing the swab test thing because, you know, I'm okay with having a sexually transmitted disease at 25 years married, but don't take away my alcohol. You know, I need that. A few months later, I finally go back to that doctor on my wife's insistence. She thinks something's wrong. She doesn't know what. Because I'm closet drinking. I remember I get pleasure by sneaking around, so I'm not getting caught very often, except it's taking me down. And I finally tell the doctor what's going on, and he goes, oh, you're self-medicating. Really? Isn't that about it? I feel that, you know, I diagnose the problem. I write the prescription. I fulfill this prescription and I take the prescription. I just cut out all the middlemen, you know, the whole deal. And I think that's so true, you know. And it was all about giving a damn how I felt. Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, said something to me. She wrote it in this journal and said, feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith. And the idea is, feelings are the physiological reaction of the body to a thought. And they have a machine called the lie detector. You know, they hook you up to it, and they ask you a few questions, you know, and then something really wild, and then the needles go up, and then your mind sees the needles going, and then this feedback loop, like taking a microphone and hooking it up, you know, to the speaker and getting that feedback going on. See, I don't know where these feelings are coming from. And if I make decisions based on these feelings, I'm like rolling the dice. The crazy part about it is, on occasions, they turn out well. But on a lot of occasions, they don't turn out well. And I think, well, that's because I'm a victim, you know. Nobody's cooperating. It turns out that I think what she's saying is, if I act on principles, then at the end of the day, I get to reach up and pluck the succulent fruit of the day well spent. I get to harvest my feelings, not act on them. Another definition of success. So, in July, my wife gives me a letter. We're living in the same house, but she says, "I don't know what's wrong with you. We might lose the house, and if we do, you may not be invited to the next one." And she gets me to agree to go to behavioral services, and I tell her I've made the call and made the appointment. I had not made the appointment. Coming down to the week when I told her I had the appointment, August 9th, 2004, I had my last drink that night. I'd been smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years. My wife didn't know it. And so I decided to quit again. 2 days into that, a little over 2 days, it's Thursday, August the 12th, 3 o'clock in the morning. I've had my 1 hour sleep, you know, battling with the demons on the ceiling. And I'm thinking about, well, I've got to lie to her again. And all of a sudden, I just got tired of lying. You know, all those plates spinning all the time, you know. Having to keep up all that. I go down to the jail meeting, and these guys we read how it works. And we read the tradition. Boy, that looks like it's difficult. And I go, let me see, you got a probation officer, you got how much time you got to be in here, how long is it going to take you to get out, how much community service time do you have? You think this looks difficult? Just listening to you guys talk about what you have to go through on a daily basis wears me out. And you think this is difficult? We tried to find an easier, softer way, but we could not. So, I got up, I got my daughter off to school, woke my wife up, she's sleeping on the couch, you know, she's not with me. And I basically said, you know, I've been an SOB, and outlined what I had done. Didn't tell her about the cigarettes until a couple of days later. But she hated cigarettes. Her father, cancer surgeon, so she was, man, that was about the worst thing I'd done. But I remember that weekend, I sat down and I wrote down all the things that needed to be done. It was about 15 pages in small print. I showed it to my wife and she said, "Certainly is a lot." I'm almost through that list in 14 years, by the way. Getting pretty close. Got a couple of them out there. But I think I knew right then I needed a different definition of success. Even though I had not been to an AA meeting yet. Something happened. That thing, and this is the part that we can't explain. I like this guy who said, doctors do not heal. They create the conditions where healing can occur. And something fundamental happened at that time. I really have not had the obsession to drink since that time. Well, I called up behavioral services to finally make the appointment. They said, "We can get to you August 31st. I said, "I don't think you understand. I've been drinking a fifth of vodka a day and I'm ready." And they said, "We'll call you back." So the next week I went and filled out like 14 pages of forms. I had this fear. I'd get panic attacks when I get around forms. And they And my wife was going to go with me. I said, no, you need to go. And I forgot about the forms. But, I mean, I'm sitting there shaking like this. I'd love to have a copy of those to see what it was. But I went ahead and filled it out anyway. I went through it. I did the action. I didn't let the fear. I just went through it. I said, I don't care. I'm talking to a psychiatrist who talks to crazy people all the time. She should be used to this, you know. So I go, and she says, can you meet with the behavioral services at 1:30? And I was a guy who used to have a pager and the Outlook calendar and people trying to get in my calendar for all this, and now I got nothing. My agenda is wiped clean. And I said, sure. And I go down there, and I get up there, and the counselor, after 14 more pages of forms, I see this counselor, and there's some books on the shelf behind him, and they're like Buddhism and Taoism and all these Eastern concepts. And he said, he said, anything else? And I said, well, I've read up on AA a little bit, and there's this God thing in there, you know, and I got a little problem with it. He said, well, you know, you were reading that book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I thought, well, but, you know, I think it's funny today. I was reading that while I was drinking, you know. And it was about success, though, again, right? But he said, you know, in that book, they talk about natural laws. I said, do you mean like gravity? He said, yeah. Well, he said, why don't you treat these like natural laws? These steps, these are the things we're showing. Why don't you treat them like natural laws? I like Chuck Chamberlain. He said, justice without judgment. If you take something and drop it, you don't need to have a court of law to decide whether the law of gravity is going to apply in that case. It just works. If you create these conditions, these things will happen. And so I said, okay. I remember coming into one of the meetings, and, you know, I'm an atheist, you know, at the time. Today, I'm a retired atheist. It got to be way too much work, and I got to be way too old for it, you know. So it's a very good time to retire. Because one of the people in there said what he had to do was start acting as if. Act as if. There's some sort of power behind these principles. And I started doing that. And I started getting some amazing results. My aunt, my mom's sister, she died at 94 years old. At age 60, she was a widow. And she started working at the Archdiocese for the Methodists in Little Rock, Arkansas. And at the eulogy, the pastor who was with her all those years, said they told a story. They said they'd gone to one of these Sunday school classes, and they were in there talking about the map of Israel and the Canaanites and all this. And she comes out, and she goes, Pastor, you know, I think we're doing this the hard way. And he said, what do you mean? She says, well, I got it boiled down to just two things. He said, oh, really? What's that? She said, reliance and obedience. And I went, I come from good stock. And that would work, I mean. Just reliance and obedience. I don't need to understand why. Richard Feynman, one of the physicists who worked on the atomic bomb project, and he's famous in so many different ways. Feynman was doing a lecture on light to some lay people in Auckland, New Zealand. And he said, you know, if you walk away from here and you don't understand the mechanism behind light, he said, don't be too disturbed. None of us do. None of us know why light travels at 186,000 miles per second. We don't know what the mechanism is that limits that. He said, I can accurately show you, though, the equations that will accurately predict how light will behave under certain conditions. And then he said something very fascinating. And he said, besides, what would be the mechanism behind the mechanism? And I went, wow, that's fascinating. Because there would be a mechanism behind that mechanism and a mechanism behind that mechanism. I see people come into the jail and they spend hours and months and sometimes years asking themselves the question, why do I keep doing this? As though somehow the answer to that question would give them a successful result. I like the guy who said, I'm a drunk because my mama had a square nipple and she potty trained me sideways. And you think, well, wait a minute, what would I do with that information, you know? Let's say that was the answer. I mean, what I like is, you know, I think what I would do is I would Practice these principles in all my affairs. Carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Try and develop and maintain a conscious contact with a God I cannot possibly understand, and add to the quality of the lives of the people around me. I think that's what I'd probably do. But since you heard my story, and the family I grew up in, I can't pinpoint why I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to practice these principles in all my affairs. Carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Try and develop and maintain a conscious contact with a God I cannot possibly understand. And try and add to the quality of the lives of the people around me. So you see, the answer to the question why does not change the prescription for action for success. It changes nothing. So, when I got the first 2 or 3 months, I saw this little ad, and it was for non-medical home health care. And so I answered the ad, and I started taking care of this couple, this elderly couple, one day a week, back to my roots at the nursing home. And that was Pauline and Bailey, and they were from North Forsyth County. And I had the last lucid conversation on earth with Bailey. He was 94 years old, and he knew he was dying. I remember about a week or so before, he said, "This is probably the last time I'll go up these steps." But he had to quit school when he was 8 years old in order to go back and work in the cotton fields in the family, because there had been a recession at the time. He said that they used to have to take the mule wagons to Gainesville, which was 20 miles away. And I can still hear old Bailey saying to me, "And a mule goes 4 miles an hour. So that's 5 hours it takes to go to Gainesville, you know. And they'd rent a wagon barn there and put the wagons up and stay with some friends. He told a story about having the first time at 12 years old, being able to drive one of the wagons back himself. And that one mule would not go up this one hill. And the sun was starting to set, and he was getting a little worried. And the sun was setting right over the top of the hill, and he saw his dad come riding back on a mule. Come get him, you know. That was the kind of role model he had as a dad. That was a success model that he had. You know, he said, he wound up, he dated his wife, dated her for 8 years and never got permission to get married. They eloped in their mid-20s and came down to a Marietta, and he worked for a guy named Ernest Barrett, who ran a dry cleaning shop. And they said he was a really good tenor if you could get him to sing, a very humble man. But he had also drove a truck for Red Rock, which got bought out by Pepsi-Cola, and he had stock, and he kept on to that. And just kept with him, a very frugal man. And here he was. His daughter had married this guy, and the guy went and mortgaged the house, took all the money and left him upside down in the house. And Bailey just went down there and straightened it out with the bank. So here he is, and then he helped raise his grandkids so his daughter could go through a master's degree in teaching. And here he was living in this house with him. And he says to me, this is on his last, I was able to relate this back to the family. Because he didn't have he kind of went out of it and then died like 3 days later. And he was talking about each of the family members. And he said, "You know," he says, "I got the nurses coming to take care of me in the evening. I got you to come here and take care of me in the morning. It's not bad for an old plow boy." You know, and I think that's what Bailey taught me. He taught me that each day, I think that's all he did, was be able to lay his head on his pillow at night and go, "Not bad for an old plowboy." You know, and success is one day at a time. I'll tell you this, it took as long for Bailey to remember 94 years of life as it took for me to remember lunch with my daughter the week before. I don't know if you get that. But at the end of your life, it's just a story. It's just a story. What's the quality of the stories you tell yourself? There's many plausible stories I tell myself. Can I pick out the ones that add the quality to the lives of the people around me? And ignore what my quality... In fact, I try not to work on the quality of my life at all. When I make mistakes when I do that. If I work on the quality of the people around me, I get quality by reflection. Because don't you remember, it's never enough. Whatever I would get would never be enough. And when I do this, everything's a present. I'm not expecting it. And yet I get some amazing things that happen in my life. That's success. I think the highest rank that I can reach on this planet is servant. You look at all the people you really admire throughout history. And what did you admire them about? Isn't that what it is? So, I want to read something here out of the 12 and 12 that got pointed out to me not too long ago. Again, but I really like it. It's on page, I think it's 124 in the 12th step. Is that it? Yes. 124. Yes. And this is about the legitimate satisfactions of right living. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside we are partners in a common effort, the well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love, freely given, surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living, for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. Thank you for letting me share.